Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride.
Hi, this is Jeff Patterson, and it is the end of April, and it is time for another episode of the Three Horsemen podcast. And I am joined, as always, by my two co-hosts. Say hello to Mr. John Stevens.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm gonna soldier through this podcast. Gosh darn it. And I am a writer and I'm a bookseller, and my bookstore should be open by the end of May.
Woo!
It's called Curious Turtle Books. I'm specializing in fantastic of all sorts, some literary stuff, lit crit, folklore, fairy tales, mythology, and a dash of history. That's going to be where I start, and we'll see where it goes from there. And it'll be online, and I should hopefully be at a couple of cons, and the ball shall begin to roll.
There we go.
And I also write. I have reviews on SF Signal. I also write for J.M. McDermott's Grump Troll, a monthly review.
Mm-hmm.
And I write other stuff, and I spend way too much time messing around on Twitter as Erudite Ogre.
Awesome. And the third horseman of the three, Mr. Fred Kish.
Hi, I also mess around too much on Twitter as Fred Kish. And I hope to be stocking John's bookstore with history, science fiction, and maybe even some games.
So I see codependency is going to be the business model.
Well, I'm hoping that he's going to downsize me significantly. And fund my retirement at the same time.
There we go. That'll work.
We'll see.
And I also blog at the Bernal Alpha, Bernal Alpha, where I occasionally post the number of books I've read during the year.
Uh huh. And our astute listeners, all two of them, will remember. Or we'll recall that in April of 2014, we broke with our previous model and actually brought a guest horseman on. And that first guest horseman is rejoining us tonight. Hi, Paul.
Hi, guys. My name is Paul Weimer. I'm a writer. I'm a blogger. I do stuff for SF Signal. I'm a co-host of the Skiffy and Fanty podcast. I show up on all sorts of other podcasts now and again, including, as you pointed out, in April 2014, The Three Horsemen. I do photography, and I don't spend as much time as I used to on Twitter because the boss is always lurking in my at work now, but you can find me at Prince Justin, Justin with a V, because it's Roman.
And if you want to hear Paul rant, go check out the latest Torture Cinema.
Oh, yes, yes. Right. Our latest source of cinema was Mazes and Monsters, and, well, yeah, I got sweary and ranty in a way that shocks everyone, it seems.
And if you want to hear Paul stop short in the middle of a sentence, chop the head off of one of his beloved boss creations for a role-playing game that he's running.
Oh, poor Laureus.
Which I got to do on Thursday.
So we decided last month, actually I think it was before that, Fred, that we wanted to talk about CJ Cherry as she's up to become the next Grandmaster, which everybody is thrilled about. I know I was really excited about that one. And we wanted to talk about it, do some rereads, talk about impact Cherry's had. So I want to throw to Fred here, because I know Fred always does his research and can give a little bit of background before we start.
Well, she has a background herself in things like Latin, ancient Greek, the classics, archaeology. I know she's a big fan, for example, of Roman archaeology. She appeared on the scene in 1975 when her first two books came out from Daw. She really appeared on the scene in 1981 when Down Below Station came out, a book she wrote actually kind of as background for her next book, Merchanter's Luck. She's written books in that universe, the Alliance Union universe. She's written the very well-regarded Shannor cycle about aliens. She's up to, I think, the 17th volume of her Foreigner series. She's written fantasy set in Russia. She's written other fantasy. She's written Dying Earth-style books. She's written shared universes. And why did it take us until 2016 to make her a Grandmaster? I don't know, but here we are.
Well, it wasn't our fault.
True. I believe it was actually Jonathan Strawn and Gary K. Wolf's fault, but that's another podcast.
Oh.
Well, for me, it was, I first encountered Fated Son Kezreth when it was serialized in Galaxy in February of 78. Mm-hmm. And as I just recently realized, even though they spelt her name correctly on the cover, they did not on the table of contents. I'm, what, 15 years old at this point? Number one, the only future history I was really aware of was Heinlein's. And I had read quite a bit, but I remember reading the first part of Kezreth and it just blowing me out of the water and then basically devouring everything that came after that. So it's kind of nice to see somebody who had such a big impact on me right in my middle formative teen years, getting a Grandmaster, as so many have, but it was still very, very nice to see that. So I want to hear Paul talk because I do love his voice, but I know that he, much like my two co-hosts, do a whole lot of reading. And just trying to give me the brief history of Paul Reading Cherry.
Okay, that's easy. Paul Reading Cherry. I first heard of Cherry in a Dragon magazine. In the early issues of Dragon Magazine being the then house organ for the Dungeons and Dragons role-playing game, there was a column called Giants in the Earth, where basically they took... I see John, I think John remembers this column, I'm sure Fred does too, where basically they took
characters... I got half my reading from it.
They took characters from different novels and they gave them D&D stats. And one day I came across Morgaine and Vanya, and I asked my brother, who are these two? And next thing I know, I'm starting to read the Morgaine novels. So, and that was like, okay, so she's got a sword with a black hole on the tip. That's really cool. I mean, I read that before I read Stormbringer, so the first deadly sword I ever came across was that rather than Stormbringer or even Greyswan Deer. Changeling is, so that science fantasy branched out. I did start tackling more of her science fiction. Down Below Station frustrated me for the first 100 pages. And I thought, this isn't as good as Morgaine. And finally, the slow burn finally hit. It's like, finally things started going wham, 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 wham. And like, okay, now I get this novel and why it got the Hugo Award. And from there, went into a Tree of Dreams and Jewels, her Portraits of Owl series. About the only chair I haven't read, oddly enough, is the Foreigner series. I'm not sure why I've not picked it up. I'm not sure I would like it, or I'm waiting for it to be finished, and it just keeps going on and on and on. And I know when the series is going to end.
Keep waiting.
I know. It may not be 17. It might be more like 12 or 14, but still, it's like, So at some point I should start this because I've read, lots of her minor stuff, Port Eternity, the Hammerfall novels. So I've backfilled most of Cherry except for this one series. It's about it's the big hole in my cherry education, as it were.
It's funny. I totally forgot about the black hole in her sword. I remember reading Implied Spaces by Walter John Williams and going, gee, this sounds familiar. Where is it from? And thank you for reminding me of that.
Oh, yeah.
I totally forgot that. That bit. Yeah, it was funny because after I read Fated Son and Galaxy, I went back and someone at the local bookstore got me a copy of Brothers of Earth, and I read that and didn't put the fact that they were in different points in time in the same universe at all. Didn't put that together at all, but I loved Brothers of Earth, and then I went back and read Gate of Ivrel. So, yeah, so it's been one of those, being able to be in at the beginning is kind of fun.
and with ebook stuff is coming back out again. I mean, the Morgaine Omnibus just came out a few months ago, and I grabbed that immediately because I know I got the paperback somewhere deep buried in my giant, not as giant as Fred's pile of books, but I wanted the instant gratification, and so yeah, I grabbed that.
Cool. That's great. So, Fred.
Yep. Where did I get my start?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I probably was aware of her before Down Below Station, but that is really the first one that I can remember clearly reading because, of course, it had a Michael Whalen cover of spaceships docking weirdly along the rotating axis of a space station. And I read that, and unlike Paul, I was hooked right away, hooked all the way through. I'm pretty sure that at least Merchanter's Luck was out around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Read that, started filling it in, and a lot of my interest in this came because I was one of the early people on the SF Lovers mailing list on the ARPANET, not the internet. So there was a lot of discussion of her there. Shortly thereafter, Down Below Station was made into a game called The Company Wars, mm-hmm. from Mayfair Games, and I happened to go to the Origin game convention where that was released, and she was the writing guest of honor there, looking very bemused, I think, because I don't think they knew what to do with a writing guest of honor at a gaming convention at that point. So she mostly wandered around and talked to people, whoever would talk to her. And I am very sorry that I never, by the time I snagged a copy of Company Wars, I couldn't find her, so I couldn't get my copy signed, and I had not known or realized she was going to be there, so I didn't bring, like, Down Below Station with me.
What year was this?
I'd have to look it up. It was maybe 85.
Okay.
That the game came out.
Yeah.
Since then, I think maybe when I got my first AOL account, there was a mailing list called Cherry List, run by some people that are still involved in the latest iteration of it. And they came up with a computer program called CHView, which was a three-dimensional star map that you could rotate and flip with all her stars.
Yeah.
And we would endlessly, this was probably the first... I had been online several years before then, but this was the first mailing list that I joined that was dedicated solely to one author, where we would discuss endlessly the timeline, what books would fit into the timeline, even how you could fit some of the non-timeline books into the timeline. When the Foreigner books started coming out, are those part of the Alliance, you know, the Alliance Union timeline,
mm-hmm.
and so on and so forth. I also am not that, I mean, the Foreigner books, are probably the ones I've read the least of because again, like Paul, I was like, okay, it's got to end at some point, so then I'll read it. And it hasn't, so I'll just have to, pick it up at some point. I think I've read all of her science fiction other than that. Most of her fantasy, the short stories maybe once. And now I've just reread I think 6 books in the past month.
Hmm.
And we'll continue probably Maybe by the end of the year I'll have enough momentum going, I'll start the Foreigner books as well, again.
You know, it's kind of funny because I, in rereading some parts of Kesrith, I remember one of the things that really appealed to me at the time, and I had read at least some of the Dune trilogy at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the thing that sort of annoyed me about Dune, as much as I ate it up and loved it, one of the things that annoyed me was that it kept trying to tackle some fairly philosophical issues, but it always did so through prophecy and religious dogma and a lot of things that I was used to seeing in fantasy books. And I, even as a kid, I was never really big on the whole prophecy thing, you know, having been raised Catholic, it just sort of was like, what? Come on. There's got to be some other motivations that can be used for getting a story rolling here. But it did appeal to that part of me. So that being said, I turn to John because I know all these things go through his mind, especially his younger self when he started picking up new authors and getting into new areas of fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's this small number of authors who I encountered in high school who pretty much became the formative foundation for, like, my future. And Cherry was one of them, because I encountered her, like I said, in high school, around 81, when my history teacher, who was my dealer for science fiction, gave me a copy of Down Below Station. And I read it, and I was like, yeah, I like it. It's not great, but I like it. And he was like, oh, how can you not like this? And he decided to take a different text, so he gave me the Fated Son books, the trilogy to read. So I began reading those, and, you know, at that time, they just blew me away. Perhaps because I felt some resonance with, you know, Nguyen's story, sort of trying to find yourself in a world that seems hell-bent on destroying you.
Mm-hmm.
And I also really took to Sten's story a lot as well, as sort of an outsider who has to figure out a way to adapt or literally die. So there were a lot of themes running through that I identified with, so I ate those pretty fast. And then he gave me the Morgaine books to read, and I tore through those, and then he gave me more Alliance Union stuff. So I read, you know, Mercander's Luck, Port Eternity, Lechner books, 40,000 in Gehenna,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, I blew right through those for the next couple of years. And then after I got out of high school, I read The Kip Strike Back, and it just didn't grab me like a lot of her previous work had. And I slowed down a little bit. And then after that I read the newer Morgaine book, Exile's Gate, and the Satine stuff. And then I started to sort of fall away for several years. I went through this period of, well, I'm in college now and I'm going to be a scholar, so I should not read the science fictional stuff again. And then when I hit grad school, I was like, I'm lonely, so I'm going to read science fiction again. And got back to them. I started reading the Foreigner series, but it was not my cup of tea. I just bounced off it. Because while it has some actually real strong similarities to the Fated Son stuff, it wasn't the same. And it just, for me, it lacked an edge that I had felt in her earlier work more keenly. Mm. And then, you know, I've read a lot of her short stories. She's a crackerjack short story writer. And you know, in my history is really that some of the themes in her books that kept coming up led to my interest in becoming an anthropology major and taking that all the way to graduate school because her themes of, you know, fitting in and trying to find your place and dealing with all the forces that conspire against you to do that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just you're out of place. It's that a lot of people are trying to push you out of place at the same time, if not, you know, outright destroy you and everybody you know and love. So that theme was resonated with me very strongly. Because it's something I struggled with for a lot of my life. So
I hear that. So.
You know, so though that kind of stuff is what made me stick with Theron. I reread the Morgaine cycle and the first Faded Sun book for the podcast. And the Faded Sun didn't hold up quite as well, but the Morgaine books were really quite good. Because I saw them with a different lens too. I mean, you know, my first pale swordsman with a amazing magical sword was Morgaine.
Yeah.
You know, and it was funny to start reading Elric later and go, separated at birth? I don't know. Although she's much more mortal, I think, than Elric is. Like a lot of Elric's weaknesses spring out of his addictions. But for Morgaine, her weakness is that she really is a human at the bottom of things. She can do amazing stuff and she's utterly determined, but she is still a human. Like, she gets hurt a lot in the Morgaine books.
Right.
You know, you're kind of used to the barbarian, like, slicing through four people and going, ah, by Ravthar's hammer, I live! And she's like, I killed 200 people with my amazing sword, but now I have to go hide for a month and rest up.
Yeah, and the novel starts with her stuck in a gate. So yeah, so she's totally not the super competent hero.
Well, I think she is, but she also just has the failings of being a mortal person. So while she may be quite competent in a lot of ways, she's not some kind of superhero.
Yeah, it's funny that you bring that up because Elric. Elric, one of the things I always found fascinating with Elric was the fact that, yes, there's addiction going on, but he is in equal parts accepting and angry at the fact that he's a pawn in this greater struggle that's going on in the great scaffold of the universe.
Right.
And Morgaine didn't quite reach into that, but being able to sort of, you know, play on the same power chords without having to drag any baggage that she didn't choose to drag with her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm the last person of my science team. I'm going to shut down these gates. No one's going to stop me. Plod, right. Plod, plod.
Right. No, precisely.
You're stabbing me, so. But I'm going to keep on going.
And something, I want to comment on something else you said, John. I remember reading Down Below Station when it came out. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that I was disappointed in the book, but the disappointment that I felt came from the fact that after having read Faded Sun and Brothers of Earth, it was a lot more of a quote unquote traditional SF book.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Then Kesrith was, and that was the part that kind of disappointed me. It got into, you know, heavy military presence and exploitation of planetary resources and stuff that I had read a lot of before. And it's not that that's wrong, but everything I had read before sort of really went outside the box and said, you know, I mean, I read Kesrith and it was like, okay, what if the Fremen decided, screw this, let's go find out where we came from, and, you know, and captured a guildsman and said, hi, take us to the edge of the galaxy so we can find out what happened before, you know. I mean, to me, that was the part that was exciting, was the fact
By the way, before we get there, you have to convert to our culture or we have to throw you in an airlock.
Right, precisely. it's funny because the whole idea of accepting that there's, you know, baggage that comes with deep history and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I remember even when I got into my teen years and I was reading stuff like this, I would go back and I would read something like like a Green Lantern comic where the Guardians were always saying, yes, we've been around for 5 billion years. And it's like, okay, well, let's hear some of those stories. I want to know what
Seriously.
Galaxy was like 5 billion years ago. Tell us, you know, tell us what was going on then. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it wasn't so much that I found it disappointing in the fact that it was a bit more traditional mm-hmm. than the stuff that it came before. Now, given time and the work that has accreted around the Alliance stories, I certainly see it being a major linchpin for setting a lot of the themes that came down. So,
I agree.
So
it's yeah. I mean, the Alliance Union stuff is good. I mean, it's definitely better than a lot of the standard issue space opera that was around at the time, and to an extent even since. I think partly because of that sense of deep history, but because the stakes are often multi-layered. It's not just...
Yeah, just you know, the personal, not just the big. It's all,
mm-hmm.
it's all a whole spectrum of stuff that's going on all at the same time, and it took me a while in Down Below Station to really grasp, okay, what's happening on the station and what's happening on the ship and what's happening between these two factions. Like, okay, it's like a tiramisu. It's like a layer cake.
Mm-hmm.
I get it. It just took me a while. I know, I still kick myself. I almost stopped reading that, and that would have been such a tragedy had I stopped reading it.
Mm-hmm.
I was this close. It's like, oh, okay, I'll give it one more chapter. And finally it broke for me.
Mm-hmm.
Such a weird reading experience that.
The other thing for me was the once we got into the 80s on a bit more of a visceral level, that when we got into the 80s was when they really started changing the trade dress on our paperbacks, and suddenly there were these movie poster, you know, I just remember the cover to Hellburner, you know, they it's like suddenly I'm watching this, you know, action film as opposed to these really, you know, otherworldly covers that we had had before, so.
Mm-hmm.
And that really wasn't an action film kind of book.
No, it wasn't.
Hellburner and Heavy Time, for some weird reason, make me feel like when I read them, it's a bad dream. Like you're trapped in a nightmare for some reason, just what that the main character is going through. You know, it's like, what's going on? What's going on? What's going on? You know, you're like just hurtling along and unable to, take command
mm-hmm.
of what you're going on.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I know Tor did a Alliance, Union timeline a while back.
Yeah, the person that did that was on the Cherry List way back when. And that's like, I forget who first did it, but, it's been basically one work that keeps morphing every couple of years as people add and subtract from it. And in the show notes, we will have, some items linking people to things like that. Because Tor did do a good reread of the whole series.
Yeah,
the books.
It did. I always liked that. I always liked that Citeen cover too. That was one of those covers that was like, this is a science fiction book. We're going to remind you of that now. You know, we're by showing you a baby in a cereal bowl.
Even better was the paperback edition, which split it into three books. So you got three weird.
Oh yeah.
Reminders that it's a science fiction novel.
Mm. So, it's funny that we all seem to be lacking in reading of the Foreigner series. We may have to do a future episode of that.
We may all have to correct this imbalance in the force. But I just want to mention my favorite Chandra cover is actually Chandra's Legacy. So, we have the picture of, what's her name has the gun and you have
right
and you have the a couple of aliens and back and the laser fire, because that tells you, okay, we have aliens with guns and laser fire. This is definitely an SF novel. And not to mention, that's the one that I think she just like had fun with, because it was set years after the original books. It's like, okay, we'll go follow the niece and let her have a, mm-hmm. have adventures running around Meat Point Station. So
Not to make this a discussion of the covers, but the cover for Merchant's Luck for me was always, looking back at it now, it's almost like sort of like when, that was like sort of like when the 70s motif of what the consensus future of mankind looked like was sort of coming to an end. You know, it still had the silver foil jumpsuit and the chock-a-block monitors everywhere and tried to make things look as futuristic as possible, and lots of people on starship bridges holding guns, which happens all the time.
So. Yep. mm-hmm. Well, here's some of my thoughts.
Okay.
Like preparing for the podcast, I reread the 4 Chenoir novels, Down Below Station, Merchant's Luck, and dipped into a few other things. And concentrating mostly on Chenoir, I mean, I don't understand, you know, again, I'll say it, why is it taking us to 2016 to get her a Grandmaster Award? Because I look at those books and, okay, you think they're just space opera. No, she's writing an alien from an alien perspective so that the quote-unquote alien in the story is a human.
Mm-hmm.
She's got the methane breathers, which are so alien that even the main races of the compact are afraid of them because you never know how they're going to react. You've got hard SF here where you've got your faster than light ships, but you have things like when they have battles, you jump into a system, you don't know what's going on, you read what you can see, but you know there's a time lag. You may aim at something, you may fire your missiles, but will that opposing ship do something in the meantime to make you miss? I mean, there's a lot of great hard SF kind of motifs in there. But then there's that thing that some groups of fans claim don't exist in hard SF or traditional SF. She's got wonderful politics. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know, John, you said you bounced off the Kiff Strike Back, but I think those three books, you know, there's the Pride of Chenoir, which is the initial book. That's almost a standalone. But those three books are one long story, and right. I devoured them this time just like I did the first time, one after the other, in the mm-hmm. space of a week, because it's just like, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? I mean, the politics are great. The opposing factions, the groups playing off against each other. It was just, mm-hmm. you know, an amazing ride. Mm-hmm. I mean, other books I like, I'm more drawn towards the Alliance Union books. I mean, you've got a lot of stuff, even in Down Below Station, you've got damaged characters with PTSD mm-hmm. before we recognized such a thing. Mm-hmm. In the field, you've got working class characters.
Mm-hmm.
You've got people. I mean, people love Firefly. Merchant's Luck. You got one guy trying to run a ship by himself.
Yeah,
you know, living. You know, they're mm-hmm. even called. I think they're called the marginal or whatever. The there's one term they use for that kind of traitor. You know, you're not most of Cherry's books in that series. You've got these big ships like the Dublin again, which features in this story, which are crewed by families. So you've got big bank accounts, nice quarters, set lines, you know, trading contracts, whatever. Then you've got all these people living on the fringe, and a lot of her books are about the people living on the fringe.
Yep.
Rim Runners, you have a ex-soldier who's trying to, you know, make her life again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a lot of stuff that I really appeals to me that, you know, I love space opera. Everybody knows I love space opera from Doc Smith onwards. But these are so much more three-dimensional than most of what's out there for all these reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, that's my rant.
Yep. I've always thought that Babylon 5 took a lot of notes from the Chenoir series.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. But, yeah.
Well, I think you get to a point where a lot of what's been, you know, contemporary, the way space opera sort of got viewed, from like the mid-90s on, I think, you know, that stamp certainly hit, stayed on quite a bit of it. However, one thing I do want to say, though, I mean, I as much as I agree with everybody on it's 2016, finally, Cherry's getting the Grandmaster, I think I've been thinking that about every single one of them since Damon Knight in 95. I mean, those first 20 years of the awards, I was like, yeah, there's a lot of really good people here, you know, and then suddenly we start getting into, you know, later and later we're pulling out and there's this entire backlog of just fantastic authors. And I remember when Connie, you know, we said the same thing about Connie Willis and Gene Wolfe and Niven and Delaney. The last 2 years, yeah, we've said the same thing. And I think it's one of those curses we're going to have as fans is that every time a new Grandmaster gets announced, we're going to go, finally! You know?
Well, it was Ellison was on a rant in the 80s. I think it was actually on Sci-Fi Channel, so maybe it was the 90s, sorry, where he was telling that, you know, pleading with the SFWA to, like, just do 4 a year. What's the big deal? Do 4 a year until you catch up.
Yeah.
And at that point, it was because he wanted A.E. Van Vogt to get one, and A.E. Van Vogt was very sick.
Right.
So, you know, come on, guys, do 4 a year. Why isn't Bujold up there as well?
Yeah.
Speaking of very similar, you know, complex stories.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a striking good point, especially when you're looking at such a departure coming out of the 70s, and you're looking at such a departure from a lot of what we had when it came to both the military and the alien encounter and interaction books that had come before that. You know, she was really tackling those things fairly hard, and also where a lot of science fiction, especially of the more escapist stripe of the 60s and 70s, one I read as a youngster and going, wow, yeah, flying around in space, woo! And then I read the Fated Sun books and I'm like, oh my God, this would suck. This would suck so much to have to go through all this, you know? And it sort of becomes this little bit of an awakening. Mm-hmm. As it comes in. But once again, I mean, perfect. It was perfect timing. I remember, you know, Heavy Metal Magazine used to do their book reviews, and they tended to fixate on the really weird, outlandish stuff that was coming out. And I just remember they would tackle her early 80s books down below Forward. They would just dive into them and, you know, just say, yeah, this is the stuff. This is the hit we need. So, pardon me. I'll let that out. Where that came from. So Paul.
Yeah.
In thinking about, you know, big future histories and stuff like this. I mean, I know your tastes run all over the gamut. You're all over the place.
I'm all over the galaxy.
You have no loyalties.
That you think it's so bad that way.
No, I'm kidding. But that being, I mean, given such a wide tent that SF is, I mean, when you're dealing with deep history, when you're dealing with constructs like this, when you're dealing with a deep history that has stories all over the timeline that is tackling all kinds of themes, not just alienation, but the military stuff and the way command structures are done, and, you know, playing in a lot of the various what if scenarios that we saw, like Butler and Le Guin working, and to a lesser extent, Pohl and authors like that who were really getting into the cost of things. I mean, the appeal is obvious, but can you put your finger on it? I mean, can you state what it is that really sparks your neurons when you're reading them?
I think you had mentioned it before with talking about the deep history. I when I'm diving into a a set of novels or stories that are all in the same temporal space location. I don't necessarily need endless references to previous events or foreshadowings of future events, because that gets to be wanky after a while. Like, yeah. Look at me, I'm going to reference this, 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 and this, but a nice sense of continuity, in the sense that these things have happened, these things are possibly going to happen, and here you are in the center, and I'm going to switch slightly from Cherry to Paul Anderson's future history for this, and you have eras of his future history going from the Polzio Technic League through the Empire, and then down that long slide of Empire that Dominic Flandre is doing his very best to try to hold off against. And there's hints there, like he goes to a planet that had been central to a novel a couple hundred years before, and this seems this whole connections of I apologize.
No, you're good.
That whole sense of things go, that sort of deep past going into the deep future. Now I'm going all over the map here. So there's a branch of fantasy which I like to call Malazan fantasy, which is epic fantasy where you have things going back absurd amounts of lengths of time, similarian style, as far as like, oh yes, this race has been around for 100,000 years, and some authors do that pretty well. Now, and some authors, it feels okay. You just like painted on the wall and said, okay, this is 100,000 years old, but I don't feel it when I see it. There's no sense of that age of what things really are. It's just decoration. There's got to be some heft to your history. There's got to be tangible points to it. Otherwise, you could just have this timeline and say, oh yeah, this happened X amount of years ago, but nothing ever really connects to it. The Traveler, I'm gonna bring in Traveler for a moment, because Fred loves Traveler. Yep. The Traveler history works like this, because you have stuff going back 50,000 years to when the ancients were mucking around with humans and wolves and spreading them all over planets, all the way through the first encounters between human and Volani, all the way up to the quote-unquote present of the game, and you get this whole Xeno, archaeology, anthropology of these cultures moving and interacting slowly through time, and all sorts of weird corners and explorations of side branches of what happened in this history. You got this little side group of humans over here, and they once turned to star nova, and nobody wants to mess with them because they might be able to do it again. And then you have this whole culture based on Psionicis, and you have the ancient Volani, and you have the Soleimani. You're like, yes, Earth, humans for Earth, because humans started here, and the rest of the galaxy is, whatever. We live where we live. And that sort of deep, long history is something Cherry's really good at in the Alliance Union universe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wanted to go to John here real quick, because, you know, he talked about, you know, relating to the outsider status that runs central to a lot of her work, and mm-hmm. thinking about that, I mean, the whole idea of being the outsider looking in, or the outsider having to acclimate to situations not completely under one's control, but at the same time being able to get away from other situations. That's a fairly common trope in literature, let alone in SF, and it really snowballed. I mean, from the 50s on, when suddenly, you know, there was such a thing as teen fiction, you know, and more and more books that were taught in schools dealt with outsider status and coping with the baggage and the challenges that come with it. But as you said, I mean, Cherry nailed it and did it by making up this entire history and this entire timeline of interactions and things that have gone horribly wrong when it comes to human expansion and the expansion of other races.
Yeah.
And how do you think, I mean, what do you think sets her take of that apart from how we've seen it done in, we'll use Heinlein as an example because it's one of, it's a note that he played a few times, but I mean, sure. You know, differentiate the two for me.
Well, I think the big thing with Cherry is that she's also very careful about how she builds her alien cultures. Mm-hmm. And the two important things, I think, are that she makes them very different but consistent. So they're not just, like, symbolic of something the author wants to convey, but there are actual modes of behavior and cultural practices that make them seem very odd in some ways, but also very consistent. So there's an idea that they're not just, you know, creatures with blue skin who dress like elves.
they're not rubber-foreheaded aliens.
That's right, exactly. They're not, you know, they're not Andorians. Like, you know, an Andorian acts just like a human. Except they have funny names, which many humans do. I mean, to other cultures. So, one of the really important things is that she takes as much time with cultural stuff as she does with historical stuff, political stuff, and military stuff.
Yep.
She has a very careful production of the world and the context and the background. And the other thing is that she really understands the dynamics of social interaction much better than many other authors do. So there's much more of a realistic feel to what happens to the characters. And the characters also behave like flawed people. The aliens are flawed and the humans are flawed, but in different ways. So you get the feeling of, like I said, a much more realistic process unfolding before you in the work than in a lot of other ones where, like, the hero, you know, slays the giant wildebeest on planet X and becomes the king of the tribe. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Huh. There's nothing facile and nothing easy. Everything has to be earned.
Right.
And there has to be a process of understanding. So yeah. I think she does that better than a lot of authors, and that's part of the formula for success for a lot of her books.
Wow.
That's one reason why I like her so much is just that mention of the aliens. Mm-hmm. You know, the Kif could have been just this, you know, cartoon villain. Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But by the end of that set of three books, they've become such a complex society.
Right.
Especially the one character that she has living on Shinor's ship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he just starts out as this, you know, sniveling little bastard. By the end, he's like basically running Kif society. It's like,
right.
And you know, all the stuff that Shinor does, you know, manipulating them or trying to act like them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in order to throw things to her advantage. It was just fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And
that behavior extends even to novels that aren't directly about...
Oh, yeah.
Like, in the Morgaine novels, one of the things that's great about them is that people have conflicting motives and change their minds and reform alliances with each other, you know, and betray and in the next hand help each other. There's a complexity there that you don't often see in... your regular sort of science, you know, science fantasy, like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's not a lot of deep politics in John Carter of Mars.
Yeah. No.
And possibly the Qual are possibly the best elves ever.
That's right.
That's right.
Well, Fred, on the military side of things, where do you think she stands in the pantheon of great military SF? And the second part of the question would be, was there anything that she brought to the table that we really hadn't seen before or that has had a much longer shelf life than expected?
I don't know why you always ask me about the military SF there.
I don't know why.
It's your bandwagon, man.
The rest of us are a bunch of hippies. That's
one of my many bandwagons.
Well, no, but you read, aside from more than me, you read a lot more military SF than me.
Oh, yeah.
Not so much a not so much a turnoff to me, but it's one of those things that I, okay, it's like another time travel story. It's a trope that I hesitate to dive into.
Yep.
Once I'm in there, I have a blast, but.
No, I mean, okay, what does she bring? What she tends to bring, I think, for the military SF is complexity, especially in terms of the characters. I mean, they're not all gung-ho. They're damaged. There are people like, let's look at the character of Mallory in Down Below Station. She's started out as a trading captain and was basically, drafted into becoming a fighting captain, lost her support from the company, but continues to fight the war and eventually jumps to the side of Pell and helps to form the alliance. But, you know, like she's got a job to do and she's going to do it even though she's bone tired, has no support, has to rule with an iron fist in order to keep things going, and try to manage the situation the best. But even her civilian characters, I like them because they're complex. They're not just goody two shoes, or they're not, you know, like the Kif again. They're not just black as night villains. You know, they've got, you know, Larry Niven, said he wanted to do the Kazin as nothing, you know, he didn't want to have them just be aliens in a fursuit. And that was something that, speaking of Traveler, Paul, that Mark Miller, one of the guys behind Traveler, said when he started doing the alien modules, he wanted that same sort of thing. And I think Cherry's another one that does this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the methane breathers are really alien. You know, it's like, what are they up to? You just cannot figure that out. Or even when they talk to you, quote unquote, plainly, what exactly, you know, you've got like 16 choices as to how to interpret what they're trying to do or what they say. Are you going to help me? Or are you going to, you know, kidnap my ship and take me off into another dimension? I don't know. So that's, you know, I like it because she brought to military SF or space opera a level of complexity that we hadn't really seen before. And unfortunately, it seems to be constantly forgotten that she did this. I mean, I love Ian Banks. People praise Ian Banks for doing similar things, but people seem to forget that Cherry was there, you know, right at the same time, not a little ahead of the curve.
I would say definitely ahead of the curve.
Yeah, especially you get a, every now and then we come out with a list of authors you should read, 100 books, this, that, the other thing. And what's the one thing that's always missing from all these lists?
Mm.
You know, not only, women. Yeah, women.
Yeah, I was ranting before because on the New York Public Library's webpage, they had books for fans of Game of Thrones, and none of them were by women, and I got really upset on Twitter and with my headache and started tweeting names of authors that they could have picked instead.
Right, yeah. There were no female fantasy writers in the 80s at all.
Aha!
Not a bit. There weren't entire shelves dedicated to it. So, no, that's true. That's really true. Is there anything by Cherry that isn't currently out on ebook?
A lot, unfortunately. Yeah.
Really?
Most of the Alliance Union books, like Finity's End, Tripoint, Rimrunners, are all out of print. Merchanter's Luck was republished by Dawn in an omnibus, and it hasn't come out. Neither has, I think, the other book in the omnibus, which was 40,000 in Gehenna.
Yeah.
Citeen, I think, is an audiobook, but not an ebook, whereas the sequel is, I believe, both an ebook and an audiobook. Devil to the Belt, or the separate versions, Hellburner and Heavy Time, she's got on her own site. That's another link that we'll include, is her website, and she does sell some of her books as ebooks. DRM free, so you can do what you want with them, but, you know, please pay the author. I think she's got the Ruskala books, the Russian fantasy books up there as well.
What about the Merovingian Night
books? Yeah, those are.
Are those there?
Which ones, Paul?
The Merovingian Night books?
No.
Because they're not an ebook either.
Yeah, that might be more of a case. That was a shared world, correct?
Yeah.
So that might be a case of getting the rights again from all the various authors.
Yeah, and that also includes the Heroes of Hell stuff she did too.
Well, that's really really even more complex. Right. I mean,
yeah, it's funny you mentioned that because I was just thinking about the fact that when the Heroes in Hell books came out, that it actually kind of surprised me that she took part in that. But then again, it kind of surprised me that everybody took part in it.
Yeah, I mean, Silverbird, yes. A lot of people.
I was like, what the hell is this?
And what kind of extortion were they performing?
I have no idea, but I remember I liked them. I liked them a lot. And that was right at a period where a lot of that stuff was starting to really flourish. So it was a lot of fun, you know? Yeah, that's, what was the other one, Paul, you just mentioned? The other series I forgot about? Oh, no, Fred mentioned the Russian books. Yeah,
right, Salka.
Yeah.
I wasn't talking about that. That was two books or three books? I can't remember now.
brain freeze. No, it was three. Rusalka, yeah. Chernobog, and Evgeny.
Yeah, I mean, it felt to me, if I'm going to compare it to anybody, maybe like Fritz Lieber at times.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy them. And I don't know I can't remember what kind of splash they made, but I thought they were pretty well received at the time as well.
The Paladin was really good. Is that in the book?
I'm not sure.
I don't believe so. I was looking at this earlier and I didn't see it as an ebook. But that's, I don't know.
Yeah, I would hope that with the elevation to Grandmaster status, this gets rectified. But I suspect that a lot of these books are caught up because the publishers were bought or went out of business. I mean, is Questar around anymore? I don't think so. Aspect, which is part of Warner, is Warner Aspect. Even a separate entity? I don't know.
It's part of the many-tentacled god.
Yeah. Even Daw, for years and years, it was so frustrating. They put the Shannor books out in this weird pair of omnibuses, which I think kept the e-books from being released separately. And then the e-books came out, but it was like the first Shannor book and the third one, but not the second one. And then like it just drove me nuts trying to get the whole set.
Oh, man. Now, something else that just dawned on me, and I don't have the answer. Has she ever won an award for short fiction?
I believe one of her Hugos is for short story, yes. Let me see if I can figure
it out. Oh, Cassandra. Cassandra in 79.
Yep.
That's right.
Yep.
That's right. I remember that. Oh, the Fairly. All right. Wow. Yeah, before she actually got anything for down below.
And oddly enough, never a Nebula.
Oh.
Two Hugos.
That is odd.
A lot of Locus, awards, things like that, but never a Nebula.
But they named an asteroid after her, so.
Yeah, there you go. Yes.
I got to reread some short fiction along these lines. All right, what else do we have to say about her?
Read her books.
People should read her.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, we were saying earlier about how she seems underappreciated for the bulk of her work and what it did at the time that it came out. People should definitely read her because the Kesrith book felt a little clunky to me when I reread it, the first one.
Mm-hmm.
But the Morgaine books are great. I mean, they're just really well done. She's really got the sort of web of, I mean, her plots are a lot more like webs than straight lines, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And you see that even though the Morgaine books are pretty direct, it's Morgaine's trying to close the gates. That's really the plot of every Morgaine book. But like I said, the way she weaves it into something more complicated and interesting would be great for writers to reread as well as readers. I mean, regular readers, it's really nicely done, and I think a lot of people like her Foreigner books now. I don't know how many of them actually go back and go to the older stuff. You know?
Yeah, I wonder if she gets a short shrift because, oh yeah, she writes those 400 novels and it's so long and no one thinks to look into the rest of her au revoir.
Right.
Like, oh yeah, she just writes that big series, that's all I have, I don't want to read that, so I don't have to care about it.
Yeah.
And then that's, that really does her,
her backlog, her backlist a disservice, yeah.
Yeah.
No, cause there's a lot to explore. I mean, there's, the stuff we've talked about, but I mean, I could go on about, you know, how she treats subjectivity in Aliens and that idea of how she weaves plots as sort of webs more than direct lines. And just the, like, her writing style isn't amazing, but it's perfect for what she's trying to do. It's concise, informative, descriptive, you know, to the point.
Punchy.
Yeah, and there's no waste either.
No, because so, some of those early Morgaine novels, I mean, for like 150 pages, you get more bang for your buck than a 700-page tome.
Yep, she condenses things. And like reading Kesworth again, the opening scene with the warriors in their house and the conversation that goes on there, it's only 4 or 5 pages, but you've just learned like some of the basic tenets of Marie culture. Right. In those 4 or 5 pages, mm-hmm. and you've got the protagonist set up, you've got the conflict mostly set up, and there you go. And she just knows how to march it out in the right pace.
Right. Well, not just that, but you talk about the density and the pacing and stuff like that. Let's not forget, she's put out a lot of novels.
Oh, yeah.
For a career that's 40 years long, she's put out,
I'm looking at the Foreigner books, I mean, like, since 1994, 1995, 1996, 1997, 1998, 2001, 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015, I mean, just like clockwork.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's just that one series.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of years she wrote multiple novels, like in 82, she wrote 3 novels.
Right.
And they're good, yeah. And they're good. They all have that distinctive Cherry style, and the mechanics at work. They're not tossed off. They're well thought out and well written, and you know there's a lot of care in them. So yeah, and I like Paul's point about how her novels aren't always very long. But they contain a lot in them.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's really trim. And I thought, when I read the Kethworth stuff for the first time, I thought, man, I wish this was longer so we could, you know, mess around and reculture more. But when I reread them for a second time a year later, even with that space of time, I realized that actually this is what you need.
Yeah.
You don't need a 4-page description of the room they're standing in, or, you know, or Nguyen dreaming about the time when he was 5 and he found a flower, and he killed the flower or something, you know. It's
783 pages for the Faded Sun trilogy altogether on Kindle. So it's right. 3 books, 800 pages.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So they're decent-sized novels, but they're not...
Yeah, but they're not... Yeah. Anything. Yeah, they're not rambling, fat, floppy middles.
Right. So, I mean, yeah, that talent is really... She uses that talent very well in her writing.
Nope. Yeah. As you said, there's a distinct economy of language that mm-hmm. goes on, especially when you're dealing with such a scope of subject matter to tackle in the course of any given... any given thing. And I'm such a sucker for long-lived universes. Mm. I've always had a preference to them over just plain old set trilogies, because I've always liked the fact that, yeah, things can continue and things go on before and after. And and so often when that gets tackled with well-known franchises, cough, cough, Dune. I'm sorry. When that gets tackled, it tends to be done in a very heavy-handed, awkward, ungainly way, which sort of draws everything down with it.
Umbering, so. Even.
Yeah.
No offense to those two authors, but yeah.
Lumbering towards Arrakis. So.
That's the next one.
That's exactly that next one.
That works. Wow. Wow. Excellent. Yeah, I mean, there's an entire series we didn't talk about, but I think people get the message.
Yeah, we can't have another two-part Horseman episode. We could, but we shouldn't.
Well, I think also with like everybody who ends up becoming a Grandmaster, there's always this extended conversation that tends to go on, around it leading up to and afterwards. I think it's discussions that need to be had. I mean, I've said a number of times, especially in the past year on this podcast, the number of things that I've gone back and read from even as recent as the 90s, entire swaths of subject matter that just get totally forgotten and entire fields that are left fallow after there's been a number of books, playing in those playgrounds. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that with a lot of different authors, and it's good to, it's good that she's getting the Grandmaster while she is still here for us to enjoy, and she is still putting this stuff out at a prodigious rate.
Yep.
Awesome. All right. Shall we talk about culture consumed?
Oh, of course.
Of course. Paul.
Okay. What has Paul been reading? Okay, so, and watching and doing. Okay, so I'll start with reading because that'll be the biggest section. And I'm on my pace for the year, but I've been reading, I've been mixing in a bunch of nonfiction along with my fiction. Most recently I read Peter Frankopan's new world history, The Silk Roads, A New History of the World. I'm not sure I buy his thesis so much, but it's, I mean, in this day of, and don't get me wrong, I like them, this whole micro history, we're going to have the history of beer or the history of cocoa or the history of one tiny bit of history, which seems to be all the rage these days, to actually have someone actually try an actual history of the world again is doing a 800 page book, actually not anything, with footnotes is not a bad thing. It's kind of almost retro that way. And I enjoyed going back into the whole timeline of history and having him see it through the, core of, Central Asia and the Middle East being the focal point that everything's revolving around for. I mean, he has all sorts of different names for the Silk Road, the Road of Oil, the Road of Peace, the Road of War, and how history has kind of flowed through this region and how this region has basically shaped the various tendrils of history. Let's see, what other nonfiction have I read that you guys might be interested in? A little further back, I also read By Step, Desert and Ocean, The Birth of Eurasia. You can see I'm on a kick on this thing, which is kind of about, again, Central Asia and its history from prehistoric times up through about the 16th century. So he goes everything from the Scythians to the Mongols. This is something that's, I've gotten really interested in the last couple of years, this whole Beyond the Great Wall of Europe, looking at those cultures and how those cultures could be used for fantasy and how they, when they have been used in the past, often been used well, except for a few authors here and there, like say Judith Tarr, and now more recently authors like say Elizabeth Baer have been taking this history and taking these cultures and bringing them to life. And this book gave me the actual history behind it, behind those cultures. And it's like, oh, that's where they're stealing that from. Interesting. But as far as science fiction and fantasy, I've been reading a bunch of the Tor novellas lately. Mm-hmm. I recently read Matt Wallace's Envy of Angels, which is kind of urban fantasy about a catering company that handles interdimensional catering opportunities for visiting demon ambassadors. And after reading Envy of Angels, I'll never see chicken nuggets the same way again. I'm not going to say why. You have to read it to find out.
Does this explain that macro picture you posted the other day?
Yes, that explains the macro picture. I took the macro. It also explains the urge to buy and eat chicken nuggets and take pictures of them. Yes, if you read Envy Angels, which actually have chicken nuggets on the cover, so you'll get why I did that. Mm-hmm. The Emperor's Railroad by Guy Heavey is a post-apocalyptic novel. Technology has dropped. That you have this post-apocalyptic wilderness. You have zombies running around. You have knights, and you have. I think I'm not sure. I suspect this is post-singularity, post-apocalyptic, because there's talk about beings called angels, and I'm thinking there was some sort of uplift or singularity, and these are the beings that are never seen. They're way off in the distance. We just meet a character who's a knight of one of them. I think that they caused the earth to go kaput, and because they mentioned at one point that one of the angels created one of the recent zombie outbursts. Thank you. Blah, blah, blah. So it was set in the West Virginia area. Nice detail, interesting characters, like that a lot. Coming a couple weeks, possibly by the time this podcast is out, is Fran Wilde's novella, The Jewel in Her Lapidary, which I adored to pieces. It's an epic story squeezed down and faceted and made into 90 pages about the end of this royal family and this family and these people who can talk to these magical gems and what happens when these last two characters are faced with the end of their society and how can they survive after the end and try to survive what's been thrust upon them in really gorgeous prose and almost poetic in how the reuse of language over and over again, description and really focus tight on the two of them and what they have to go through. And I really like that a lot. And I think readers will like that a lot when it comes out. I reread a Norman Spinrad collection, The Star Spangled Future, because I got talking to Fred about a story in there. And it's like, okay, I'll just buy the collection again. I have no idea where my paperback is, and I'll just reread it. Norman Spinrad is, again, it's on and off of me. Sometimes his stream of consciousness stuff works, and sometimes it doesn't. And it was nice to go back to an early collection I had read years and years ago, and I like that a lot. What else can I mention? For those who don't know it, SFF Audio, a couple of us have been re-listening to Philip K. Dick novels, so I've been doing a bunch of that lately. Clans of the Alpha Moon, The Crack in Space, The Simulacra. We've been kind of like going through the old war one by one, and that's been a lot of fun to see them in a new way, the ones I have read and listening to those I haven't before and really just like filling in those holes. And rewatching Babylon 5 season 2, because we're going to be doing that for the Skipping Fandy podcast. And Sean's never seen it before. He's trying not to spoiler things as we're discussing. And Mike Underwood and I are discussing it with him because we don't want to ruin it for him what's going on. And he got really upset because in season 2, if you recall, we switch main characters, and Sean did not like this change at all. It was hilarious. That podcast will come out in a couple weeks, and you'll get to hear his reactions to that. And one last thing, one kind of weird out of left field thing. I don't have the computer to run it, I don't think, which is sad, but I've been watching the playthroughs of the Paradox people have been doing for their forthcoming 4X space strategy game, Stellaris. Have you heard about this one, Fred?
No, I don't think so.
It's basically a real-time strategy game, basically procedurally generated galaxies, all sorts of alien races, and basically go forth and explore and conquer the galaxy. I've been watching their videos on their YouTube channel of them playing this game. They decided, just to show how weird this game, you could play this game, they created a space fungal race called the Blorg, and so all hail the Blorg, who just want to go out and try to make friends, but they made the race unappealing to everyone, so they're trying to make friends with anyone, but nobody likes them. It's a really fun game, and the Martin and Anders are the two Paradox developers who are playing the game. They have really good rapport, and they go through and explain the game, and in going through the ins and outs of sometimes of new builds, they're like, oh, we lost that feature, so they don't know, we no longer can do this, and it's been really entertaining. It makes me wish I had the money and discretionary income to upgrade my computer so I could buy a copy of this and play it when it comes out, which should be like the second week of May. So that's all the culture I've consumed. All the culture I've consumed. I could go on for another hour, but I don't think you guys want me to.
John, what about you?
I read a bunch of C.J. Cherry books, okay? But other than that, I read Amanda Downham's book, Dreams of Shred and Tatters, for review at Grumptural. And it was good. It wasn't awesome. There's some things that definitely recommend it. It's a nice alternative take on urban fantasy, essentially. You know, in a lot of urban fantasies, you have these wars being fought between, like, some sort of goodish guy and some sort of baddish person, and, you know, they're all wizards and demons and werewolves and hellhounds, and they somehow manage to romp through the streets slaughtering each other with no one taking notice. The world here is much more Lovecraftian, actually more Chambersian, I guess, is a better way to put it. And it's not one of these we have to save the world things necessarily. It's really a book about saving one person. And that focus is a really nice change. There's still a lot of bad stuff happening. And a lot of people are getting hurt, and the outcome, and if they can't accomplish their goal, the outcome is very bad. But it's almost intimate. It's a really close sort of story with a few characters trying to figure out how to essentially rectify a wrong. And I appreciate it for that. But I thought that it was a little too rushed. We don't get a lot of time to sit with the characters. A lot of the characters seem very cardboard. And that detracts from the feeling of the characters that are well developed. And it just makes it disappointing in a small sense. And it's fairly well written, but there's sort of an not an excess to the language, but and not, you know, we were talking about Cherry's economy of language. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely some economy in Downham's writing, but I don't think it's fully thought through. So it doesn't give the maximum effect that I think it needs to give. And I think in the end I basically said, you know, people should read it because there's some really good stuff in there, but it didn't all come together for me.
Hmm. That's the King in Yellow take one, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I think I have that on my Kindle as yet unread.
And some of her descriptions are great. And I like the idea of what's going on more than its execution. I think that's a good way to sum it up. There's a really intriguing story there, and I just don't think it gets its full exposure. So I read that. I just finished Bob Prohl's book. His title escapes me now, which I'm going to make sure I grab it right before I say it. Hold on one second. Why don't you tell me the title? And no one's gonna tell me the title.
Because we don't know what it is.
It's like, I want to say it's 1,000 possible worlds, but I think that's not right. 100,000 worlds. There we go. I got it. Because I just finished reading it. I'm like, the title? What's that? And to sort of, you know, put a disclaimer, I know Bob. We live in the same town. We're both booksellers in the same town. So, you know, we are acquainted. But I've never read any of his stuff until I got this to read. And it's quite good. It is not speculative fiction, but it is about speculative fiction. It's about, it's basically about a woman taking her son across country, and she does stuff at cons, so he's exposed to that world, and it's partly about how people create family, create connections, but it's also, I mean, it's sort of about growing up, and it's about, you know, how you look in the world in a different way, and how you create the world yourself. Every day, we create the world that's around us, basically. And it's very well written. Bob is he's really crisp. He's not as concise as Cherry is, but his writing is really crisp. And I just found it really easy to get into it and sit with it and go along. So it's a good story. The characters are great, and I think he flounders a little in a few spots, but overall, it was a pretty good read, and I'm actually working on a review of that now that I will give to somebody, maybe SF Signal. And that I highly recommend.
That's coming out in June, right?
It is. And it's not gonna be out for a little while, but I have an advanced copy, which is quite lovely. And like I said, I highly recommend people read it when it comes out. And other than that, I'm trying to make progress on a couple of books I've been reading for a while. One is called Black Box, which is sort of a written toolbox of anarchist tools. It has articles by Le Guin and a lot of other people. I'm slowly making my way through that. I'm reading poetry here and there. And as far as watching stuff, I don't think I've watched anything sort of genre recently, except I followed Walking Dead Season 6 to its incredibly stupid end. and you know, people, you know, some people put down Walking Dead a lot for its storylines and how it wraps up things. And it's true that in previous seasons there have been unsatisfying, you know, endings. But this one is bone, stick, stone, stupid.
Oh boy.
And of course I'll watch on the next season's premiere to see how they resolve this idiocy. And then disappointed, we'll move on. But I think the problem is I sort of come and go to Walking Dead because it's not very well written. And the pacing is strange because it feels like it loops a lot. I feel like people say things more than once in different ways during an episode, for example, as if they're trying to hammer certain things into the viewer's head. But I find some of the characters really intriguing. And the way that it at least tries to tackle how would you live if there was an actual zombie apocalypse, I find interesting to watch to see what I feel they do that works and what I don't. And, you know, I think the biggest problem with the show is that just they always get to a point where they're like, what should we do? Oh, let's have someone do something stupid. That'll get the plot going along. They do it, and they do that all the time. It's
that's
like
a stupid ball.
The idiot ball.
Yeah. Idiot ball, yeah.
There are so many ways to build tension and build conflict without someone being an idiot all the time. I mean, people are idiots sometimes. That's true. But I'm talking monumental, like, civilization-destroying idiots. And, So anyway. And I think that's all I've watched for sort of genre stuff. And like I said, with books, a lot of my time was devoted to the Cherry stuff. And I think that's it for me.
Wow. A nice little run. Fred.
Well, I read a lot of C.J. Cherry.
That's going around.
It's a theme.
Yep. Otherwise, I am reading all the Nebula nominees more or less simultaneously for another podcast. I finished of that pile Fran Wild's Updraft. I mean, I started this whole project with my daughter having read more Nebula nominees than I have for some odd reason. So I enjoyed that a lot. It put me in mind of, there was actually a George R. R. Martin collaboration about, the Winds of, man, Windhaven or something like that, way, way back when.
Oh yeah, Windhaven.
Yeah, Windhaven. So, kind of put me in mind of that. I'm not decided yet whether I think it's really science fiction or fantasy. I mean, there's no, quote, magic, unquote, except for maybe one thing.
I know what you're talking about.
So, you know, I mean, it could be like Pern. It could be Lost Colony or something. I'm just not decided. I enjoyed it. It moved very quickly. You know, they went through a lot for one book. So that's, something I'd recommend people look at. Another item I read was I finished rereading The Hobbit. I was intending, beginning this year, doing a reading through of the old Ballantine adult fantasy series from the 70s. As mm-hmm. usual, any reading plan that I create does not survive contact with the year. So I have no idea how far I'll get with that. So other things I've read, well, there's all that C.J. Cherry. So let's move on to other things. And definitely in the genre camp, we picked up the original, well, I guess it's not the original series, actually, the 1966 Batman series, and we've been watching like one or two episodes a week. We're almost done, I think, with the first season, and it's been a lot of fun. I mean, you can sit there, you can analyze the episodes down to a precise formula almost, but we're still enjoying it. We laugh at the Gotham City Police Department, which never seems to be able to solve any crimes.
They do save them, Batman and Robin, dead on at least once when they got trapped in that big book.
Yeah, but it's hilarious. Like, the first season, every episode begins with Commissioner Gordon saying, well, can we do this? And all the the chiefs, I guess.
Chief O'Hara.
Well, there's the chiefs and they're, I forget what the next level is, the inspectors, I think, all standing there going, oh, not us, not us, not us, you know, and they pick up the bat phone. It's like, what the hell did they pay you guys money for? but on the other hand, we're watching it. It's like, you know, that police force is probably more integrated than most big city police forces are today, even. I mean, they had a black inspector. You know, that's like, you don't see that even today in most cities. So we're enjoying it. I was inspired to buy this because of there's this one Twitter account, Bat Labels.
Oh yeah.
Which is
just
hilarious. You know,
it's
just
awesome.
Nonstop, really hilarious signage that you find in the series. The other bit of TV that I've been doing, it's not genre, but it's a genre writer. The Happen Leonard series, which was on Sundance, and I believe is being reshown on another, maybe AMC is doing it as well. Happen Leonard are a pair of people living in Texas that get into all sorts of trouble. The first season is basically the first book of the series.
Savage Season,
right. And they've got, I mean, the first episode was on, my wife and daughter were kind of vaguely aware what I was watching something, and without giving away exactly what happens, when the last scene of that first episode happened, they both looked at the TV and they're like, what the hell were you watching? So of course now I've shown it to them from the beginning again, and they're still kind of like, what the hell is this? But they really did a good job. I mean, I don't think they've got a lot of budget, seeing that it's Sundance. I have no idea how much money a channel that mostly shows 80s movies appears, has, but they did a really good job casting. I think they may have spent more money. The most money they probably spent was probably finding cars from the 80s. But, you know, great, really gritty, good actors all around, actresses all around, and it's, you know, enough true to the books without being slavish. Good interpretation. So I'm really enjoying that.
Nice.
And that is my culture consumed.
Ah. And I just want to intercede real quick. I actually saw the first two episodes.
Okay.
Because they were free on the Sundance website. I don't know if they are anymore or not. And I have to pretty much agree with Fred. It's the tone is definitely faithful to the books.
Yep.
I was kind of unsure about James Purefoy as a Texan.
Yeah.
while his accent wanders a little bit, he really has the character down.
Yep.
He really has
when I first saw the ad, I was just watching. I was sort of like, wow, damn, that's fairly decent casting. So.
Yeah, and John, I think you'll agree that you'll never look at Disco the same way again, will you?
No.
I will mention, I recently completed a quest I did not realize I was on. I now have a copy of every U.S. edition of Gödel Escherbach by Douglas Hofstetter out there.
Ah!
I'm overdue for a reread of that.
Dun-dun-dun, I guess.
I know that Keith Candido has been doing a Batman rewatch on tour, and I had been watching it since we had MeTV, because they show it as part of their Saturday night. They used to do two episodes per night. They knocked it back to one since they added Incredible Hulk to the lineup. And one of the interesting things about his rewatches is that he'll actually critique the actual crime and its resolution.
Yes.
How sensible or stupid the scheme is to start with. And that's the more fascinating part. So every time one comes on Saturday night, I'll see what it is, and I'll say, oh yeah, I just read his review of this a little while ago. So
yeah, I think I'm going to pick up the DC Batman 66 line just because it continues the series.
That's one of those things that I kind of ran hot and cold on.
Yeah.
I did read the beginning of the crossover with Man from U.N.C.L.E., and I know there's a crossover with Steven Peele, The Avengers, coming up as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, I have not, still, after 2 months of saying I was going to read it, still not read Medusa Web by Tim Powers. I'm not happy about this situation. However, I've been so damn impressed with Al Ewing and what he's been doing in Marvel lately, especially he's been the one real shining light for me, at least since Secret Wars, that I went and read Fictional Man, the book that he put out a couple of years ago, I think. And I really enjoyed it. Almost a casual history of fictional characters being citizens, and I really enjoyed it quite a bit. I don't know why, but I read the first two of Ron Goulart's series, Groucho Marx, Master Detective. I was sick. I didn't feel like grabbing a physical book, so I grabbed whatever I had on my tablet at the time, and it was those two. And they're good. They're funny, but it's just, I'm still trying to figure out why these books were written. These books could have been written with original characters, and I think they would have played just as well. Going through a box of comics a little while ago, moving stuff, I came across Marvel's very slipshod attempt to turn Lynn Carter's Thongar into a comic book.
Oh, God.
Oh, Jesus.
Which did not work all that well. And I said to myself, well, before I pass judgment, I should go back and read Wizard of Lemuria, which I did. And it is definitely superior to the comics. However, there are some things tone-wise that I do have to give the comics credit, that they they really made an attempt to be faithful to the kind of world building that Lynn Carter did in those books when it came to how the adventures were played out in the environments that he passed through. I will give them credit for that, but at the same time, that book lasted much longer than it needed to after the first issue. One nonfiction thing that I read, Susan Jacoby wrote a book called Strange Gods, A Secular History of Conversion, and it's sort of about the concept of religious conversion throughout history. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of fascinating. We talk about, you know, outsider status and otherness and the way that various cultures end up clashing, and this book covers a lot of that. I was particularly fascinated with the story of Margaret Fell, who was one of the founders of the Society of Friends in England, and how the schism led to the society being formed and all the stuff that happened to her in the immediate aftermath of that, you know, being imprisoned and stuff like that. I was really fascinated by the story, amongst many fascinating stories that are in this book. And it was just, you know, we talk about, you know, sweeping changes that occur in cultures and the fictional impact that they tend to have, and just going back and reading a history of a collection of times when some really big changes did tend to fall down on certain aspects of society, was pretty impressive. Good stuff. I'm not going to talk about too many first issues in comics. I'm going to talk about some first storylines that just wrapped up. The first of the James Bond arc that Warren Ellis is doing finished, and I was pretty damned impressed with it. He really, when the book started, I thought it was a little too Warren Ellis-y, I guess, for not for anything else, but he really did a good job putting it together. And that's going to be collected. And there is another storyline that's going to be coming out, very shortly. I think later this year, the second arc is going to be occurring. I want to talk about Huck by Mark Millar and Raphael Albuquerque. This was the book where Mark Millar, apparently after having watched Man of Steel, said, you know what, I've got to stop killing and maiming people in comics and write a fairly feel-good comic book. Much to everybody's joy. This is a really good story. It's about a small town in the middle of nowhere, and there is this one guy that lives there, Huck. He's a fairly simple guy, but he has tons and tons of superpowers. And everybody in the town, he's sort of like their little secret. And a new couple rolls into town one day, and they're sort of exposed to this. And the wife of the couple that moves in ends up calling the press and telling them about it. And the door is blown off, and suddenly everybody in the world knows about this guy. And it turns out he has a past he's unaware of, and there's a reason why he exists. And as that entire conspiracy comes into play, he sort of gets wound up on it. And he's a very sort of straightforward, always do good Boy Scout kind of character. But as the story progresses and he realizes that he's no longer, you know, saving dogs and putting out fires, and that he's actually dealing with some genuinely evil people, he really steps up to the plate. And I was very impressed with the book. And I'm really hoping that we're going to see more of it. Raphael Albuquerque does some pretty somewhat sketchy art, but it's pretty tight. The first of Holly Black's Lucifer, the first story arc of that just wrapped. Cold Heaven was the name of it. And she has repeatedly managed to nail down a lot of the feel of what Mike Carey did with Lucifer. I think internally, though, the story starts to, she walks into the story with too many givens, and she really doesn't flesh them out all that much. It was good. It's a mystery. that Lucifer is involved in, and it was pretty tight, and it has a pretty extended sequence where they have to go through the dreaming to find something, which was quite enjoyable. In the meantime, there's once again a plot going on with the angels in God's absence, and it was pretty good, but it's almost like there were a few too many threads running through it. And I'm a little concerned about this book because Vertigo just had that big shuffling around, and apparently Shelley Bond is no longer there anymore. So I'm concerned as to what's going to happen with a lot of the older titles that are being brought back. I mean, there's been some decent new Vertigo stuff lately, but I'd really like to see some of these properties get extended a little bit. You know, it'd be nice to see them, allow them to be fleshed out. I mean, one of the reasons that the original Lucifer worked so well was the fact that he got to play over 70 issues and he really got to tell the story really well. Clean Room by Gail Simone, its first arc wrapped up with a pretty gruesome, visceral bang. There was a standalone story that just came out, but that book looks like it's going to be continuing. The only first issue, and there were quite a few first issues, Joyride came out and something else came out. The first issue I do want to talk about, though, is Heartthrob, which is by Oni Press, by Christopher Sabella and Robert Wilson IV, which sort of plays with it's running into a similar flavor of things like Sex Criminals and stuff like that. It's about a woman who got a heart transplant, and it turns out that she's being haunted by the original owner of the heart. And this is happening to her just as her life really starts to fall apart. And the first issue was a really good setup, ending with a cliffhanger that was kind of like, whoa, so there's a lot we still have to learn about these characters. And I was very impressed with it. Some good stuff. Marvel's been all over the map, and I'm getting a little bit, Kelly Thompson and G. Willow Wilson wrapped up the first arc of A-Force. Mm-hmm. And this happened right around the same time as the Captain Marvel book, which is, make sure I don't screw this up, that's being written by Michelle Fasikas and Tara Butters. Both of these books are sort of, they seem to have very similar aims. And the A-Force book came so close, did such a great job with all of the characters, and really created a threat that was kind of intriguing. But remember a couple of months ago I made the comment about this thing that's going on with Marvel, with every single character has to be a smart aleck?
Yep.
This book managed to be guilty of that at least once every issue. And I can't even state this as an objective criticism, but this is something that Marvel really doesn't want to let go of. And I'm getting a tiny bit bothered by it. It's almost like nobody is taking their, you know, great power comes great responsibility, but nobody seems to be taking that responsibility seriously. It's just me. Some excellent sequences and a really neat cosmic threat that was brought up that was very inventive, and I really hope they can get back into that, because right, like I said, Al Ewing has just been hitting it out of the park when it comes to the cosmic stuff for Marvel right now, and it's been the one real bright spot in a otherwise fairly messy regrouping after Secret Wars. So quite literally, there are a lot of people that are complaining, people that have been reading comics since the 80s and 90s, that are saying, wow, Marvel's fairly unrecognizable. And yes, that's true, and that in and of itself is not necessarily a bad thing, but there just doesn't seem to be any internal inconsistency editorially to the entire line right now, which is something that Marvel always had. And even though there's a ton of baggage that comes with it, with long-term reading, at least the Marvel Universe always had the strength, especially during the 80s and somewhat more in the 90s, wherein if you were reading one book and you enjoyed it and it featured a character from another book, it was fairly easy to hop into that other book. You know, I mean, part of this is the problem of writing for the trades, but part of it is also just sort of, you know, reinventing wheels. And even though they're reinvented very well, they're not necessarily the same gauge as the other books that are running along at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates a kind of a weird tonal shift, you know? I mean, let's say you got the Avengers movie and then suddenly you make the Lego Avengers movie and then you say, oh, by the way, these are canon. I mean, it feels like that. It's that level of, you know, where are we at this point? So, but that's about it. I haven't been watching any TV aside from Archer, and I really haven't had time to do much else. So that's about all I got. Well, this means that in April of 2018, we'll have to have Paul on again.
True.
keep the pattern going. I'd be happy to come back to talk about
the Foreigner series.
Yes.
Maybe we'll catch up by then.
Well, there'll be eight more books in it by then.
Yeah, it'll be like 20. It'll be 24 of them by then or something.
True.
Yeah, it's like 17 now. Yeah, it's like
there was a joke. There was a Jay Leno had a special on NBC years ago where he did this skit where he was talking about his car collection and how much he loved old gas guzzling cars from the 50s, and he pulls up to this gas station in this just giant monstrosity, and they hired all these short guys to play the gas station attendants so the car looked even bigger. And the guy is pumping gas, and he looks up at Jay Leno and says, do you mind shutting the engine off? You're getting ahead of me. You know, the car is consuming more gas than we're actually putting into it right now. So it feels like that once in a while with a lot of stuff that's going out with book releases, that it's like, no, don't put these out yet. I still have so much to get to. So
yeah, I'm looking at my TBR pile. Yeah. Shaking my head. I'm being slowed down a bit because UPS is being stupid and sending my packages to a dry cleaning place, but.
Yeah, I saw that. I was like, what the hell?
Because that's the, for some reason they've changed their policy and they won't send it to the apartment complex office anymore. They send it to the nearest UPS my access point, which is a dry cleaning place. A quarter mile away. It's like about a half a mile away. It's like, what the hell?
Seriously.
And wow. I went there to get the package and took her 10 minutes to apparently find it. So apparently they do this a lot. It's like, God. Ugh.
Wow. Yeah, I don't have that problem. So. All right. Well, Paul, it was awesome having you on again.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me back.
Yeah. And we will be back next month with another episode. And I thank everybody for listening.
Good night.
Good night.